After enduring COVID-19, global health officials push for an international pandemic treaty. This is Brief Before Impact. Hi, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining me. I am Matt Barker. Today's brief is going to be discussing the recent push for a pandemic treaty between nations in the event that we experience another kind of a global pandemic that we like we experience with COVID-19. There will be the tools and communication available for countries to be prepared, have a better access to what's really going on to make the right assessments for their own citizens. So we're going to cover, going back to what we talked about before with the World Health Organization, what it is, what it's attempting to create with this these guidelines and this new treaty, as well as how treaties are actually passed, how they actually affect American citizens, and the debate between the political left and political right and how such international treaties affect American citizens and our politics, generally speaking. Before we get into it, I'm going to take a quick ad break and then we will get to work. Welcome back, everyone. Let's just get into what an international agreement on pandemics would look like, what its purpose would be, according to the Council of the European Union. The proposal for an international instrument on pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response is guided by a spirit of collective solidarity, anchored in the principles of fairness, inclusiveness, and transparency. Neither individual governments nor the global community can entirely prevent pandemics, but the international community needs to be much better prepared and better aligned in responding to possible future pandemics across the entire cycle of detection, alarm, and response. The instrument would set out the objectives and fundamental principles in order to structure the necessary collective action to fight pandemics. An international convention, agreement, or other international instrument on pandemics would support the focus on the following: early detection and prevention of pandemics, resilience to future pandemics, response to any future pandemics, in particular by ensuring universal and equitable access to medical solutions such as vaccines, medicines, and diagnostics, a stronger international health framework with the World Health Organization as the coordinating authority on global health matters, and finally, the One Health approach, connecting the health of humans, animals, and our planet. More specifically, such an instrument can enhance international cooperation in a number of priority areas such as surveillance, alerts, and response, but also in general trust in the international health system. So that is essentially what an international pandemic treaty would look like, what its aims would be, and how it would be impacted, or I should say how it would impact countries in the event of another pandemic being spread throughout the world. I think the bottom line is, for at least evaluating the text here, is that more cooperation is kind of the bottom line, if I can use one bullet point to describe what we just read. But it leads me to think the WHO, we've talked about in previous podcast, and their effectiveness or lack thereof during the pandemic, at least in the early days and throughout. But I wanted to remind us all, if you didn't hear that past episode, of who the World Health Organization is. What did they actually do? All right. So according to the Council on Foreign Relations, created in 1948 as a part of the United Nations, the WHO has a broad mandate to guide and coordinate international health policy. Its primary activities include developing partnerships with other global health initiatives, conducting research, setting norms, providing technical support, and monitoring health trends around the world. Over the decades, the WHO's remit has expanded from an original focus on women's and children's health, nutrition and sanitation, and fighting malaria and tuberculosis. So, as the WHO has been funded and grown in size, obviously its mandate has broadened out, and we saw it today, I should say, in the outbreak of COVID-19. Now, it leads many to ask, what kind of conclusions has the WHO made about COVID-19 and just more broadly, you know, international public health in defining such pandemics moving forward? Now, according to the WHO's website, in a consensus decision aimed at protecting the world from future infectious disease crises. The World Health Assembly agreed to kickstart a global process to draft a negotiation and to negotiate a convention, agreement, or international instrument under the Constitution of the World Health Organization to strengthen pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. So clearly, the WHO saw the shortcomings of its own organization and international public health while dealing with COVID-19 and have led them to believe that there are processes to be put in place and to ratify between United Nations members and WHO members as to fighting back against these types of pandemics in the future. Now, again, according to WHO, their director of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, said the decision by the World Health Assembly was historic in nature, vital in its mission, and represented a once-in-a-generation opportunity to strengthen the global health architecture to protect and promote the well-being of all people. Quote, the COVID-19 pandemic has shone a light on the many flaws in the global system to protect people from pandemics. The most vulnerable people going without vaccines, health workers without needed equipment to perform their life-saving work, and me-first approaches that stymie the global solidarity needed to deal with a global threat, end quote, from Dr. Tedros. So now, if you remember back and you were keeping an eye on the WHO's comments in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, you might remember when the director of the WHO was chastised by leaders around the world for making what appeared to be very positive comments on how China was handling the COVID outbreak. And I'll go back to some of these quotes that were said. You know, this is according to Stat News in early 2020. Okay, the leaders of the World Health Organization praised China's response to the ongoing outbreak of the novel coronavirus that emerged there and has since spread to more than a dozen countries. Again, this is early 2020. Dr. Tedros said about China, quote, its actions actually helped prevent the spread of coronavirus to other countries. He said he was very impressed and encouraged by the president's detailed knowledge of the outbreak. He's referring to President Xi Jinping. These are very positive comments towards China and what it was doing as a country and telling public health officials around the world of how the coronavirus was developing, where it came from. As you may recall, though, there was a great deal of different narratives being produced by the Chinese Communist Party and what actually, or where I should say, where the coronavirus came from and where it was going and its actual effects on human beings. Now, the comments that Tedros made, he took a lot of heat for those. Now, most recently, just to see as his opinion has evolved and his tone towards China has actually changed in the last couple of months, he shared an opinion countering China's current actions on preventing the spread of COVID-19 and the Omicron virus. According to Health Policy Watch, China has defended its strict no COVID strategy and called the WHO irresponsible following critical remarks from the head of the World Health Organization. Dr. Tedros told the media that China's strategy was no longer sustainable in the face of the more infectious but less lethal Omicron. Quote, when we talk about the zero COVID strategy, we don't think that it's sustainable, considering that the behavior of the virus now and what we anticipate in the future, Tedros said. Now, internally, Chinese officials actually censored media references to what is a rare public criticism of the global health agency of a particular strategy. So Tedros' early days, perhaps trying to include the Chinese party, the Chinese government, as much as a cooperative partner in this global health crisis. And so he led to making complimentary types of comments towards President Xi and his handling of the crisis. Moving forward a couple of years, scorning the Chinese policy of the zero COVID strategy. Some might wonder, where is Tedros kind of coming from in his approach to public health, his ideology? A little background about this individual. According to Observer Research Foundation, it's interesting to note that Tedros started his political career by aligning with the TPLF. It's a hard left organization that later became a part of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. Now, this group was a coalition of left-wing parties that ruled Ethiopia until just the last couple of years. And that group that Tedros started with, the TPLF, it was classified as a terrorist organization in the Global Terror Database. Now, according to just one Ethiopian newspaper, Tedros was listed as the third most important member of the TPLF's Politburo Standing Committee. So, you may imagine, at least one or two raised eyebrows from Americans when the WHO, and organizations that at time praised China during the global pandemic, and is being led by a man formerly involved with a political movement based on Marxist-Leninist ideology, begins pushing for more access and influence to American public health policy. Concerns are raised. Now, what authority does the WHO actually have related to the American sovereignty? This is really all that matters, at least in my mind. International organizations, other countries can say whatever they want with what America should be doing or how we should be handling policies. Frankly, I really don't care unless they have certain influence and sway over my life as an American and over my elected leaders and officials and so forth. So let's evaluate. What can the World Health Organization actually do to you and I and Americans and how we handle life and, more importantly, our national sovereignty? Now, according to Think Global Health, when adopted in 2005, the International Health Regulations, this is IHR for short, it constituted the most radical international legal agreement on global health ever created. After China's cover-up of the outbreak of the severe acute respiratory syndrome, which is SARS for short, back in 2003, WHO member states gave the WHO the discretionary power to share information about serious outbreaks when countries fail to be transparent and cooperative. Basically, WHO members said, all right, WHO, if an outbreak's happening in a country and country X is not sharing necessary data to help prevent the spread of that in other countries that are members of the WHO, you can go ahead and share information that's publicly available that you can find about this outbreak. That's basically what it's saying. Continues on, the WHO members states defined a, quote, public health emergency of international concern. This is a key description, because it is this concern in the international health regulations that gave the WHO director general the authority to declare a public health emergency of international concern, even over the objection of the state most directly affected. So back to our little example, country X has an outbreak. They don't want to share any information and they don't want the WHO to share information. The WHO, by the authority given to it by its members, said the WHO can declare a public health emergency of international concern. This is the power in the IHR that most challenges national sovereignty. Okay, under the IHR, the director general makes recommendations. That's the key word, recommendations on how member states should respond to a public health emergency of international concern. But those recommendations are not binding for member states. So in its current status, this is all the WHO can really do in terms of its authority. It can say country X has an outbreak. They're not sharing information. Here's what we know is available about it. We're declaring a public health emergency of international concern. And here are our recommendations on how to handle this public health emergency. Take it or leave it. That's what countries can either use those recommendations or not. It's up to them. So if this is in fact the basis of how the WHO operates, who they're being led by, how they've handled the pandemics in the past, I wanted to use a current international agreement that we're all kind of familiar with to actually kind of get into the nuts and bolts of, well, if the United States signs up for anything, a future pandemic treaty that's being discussed, what actually happens to Americans? How are we actually impacted by it? So I want to discuss the Paris Climate Agreement. It's purely just as an example of trying to understand how international agreements are understood and debated from a legal perspective on how they affect just the countries that sign on to them. And I figured that the Paris Climate Agreement is most resonant in most of our minds because it is still in the international debate. So you might have some grasp of kind of how it works. So I want to give you a little bit of outline of a legal perspective on such international agreements. And we're just using the Paris Climate Accord as an example. So, according to the World Economic Forum, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is unequivocal by describing the 2015 Paris Agreement as a, quote, legal binding international treaty on climate change. Yet the treaty itself has few legal teeth. It doesn't impose penalties, such as a fee or embargo, for the parties who violate its terms. And there is no international court or governing body ready to enforce compliance. That has prompted some prominent experts to argue that the Paris Accord is not a legally binding document after all. Legal scholar Daniel Brodinski, Arizona State University, he disagrees. The binary argument obscures a more nuanced truth, he wrote in Resil, an environmental law journal in 2016. While nations in other jurisdictions can set clear rules about the legal power of contacts within their borders, it's not so clear in international law. The enforceability of agreements rests on a common understanding of what a legal bond means in the global community. Quote, ultimately, legal bindingness reflects a state of mind of officials who apply and interpret the law. These are the judges, executive branch officials, and so forth. But also to some degree of the larger community that the law purports to govern. And he wrote this shortly after the deal went into effect. Now, the power of the Paris Agreement, in other words, relies on a fluid agreement about the consequences for a violating international agreement, one not precisely defined. Again, quote, it depends on what the British philosopher Hart referred to as their internal point of view, Brodinski added, a sense that a rule constitutes a legal obligation and that compliance is therefore required rather than merely optional. If this seems like a little difficult legal jargon to wrap your mind around, because I certainly have to read this again, to understand that he's pointing out that international agreements that are like this with no like legal penalties if someone's not following the rules. In other words, any of the words of an agreement, such as an international agreement like the Paris Climate Accord, for example, and potentially a pandemic treaty in the future, all this debate of what it actually can do, again, using Brodinski's words, is a sense that a rule constitutes a legal obligation and that compliance is therefore required rather than merely optional. This is the debate of any of these international agreements. And we're going to pivot right into these international agreements made in the United Nations or other bodies and how they actually affect Americans and American law and our constitutional process. So as a government class 101 little refresher, let's all be reminded on the rules of treaties here in the United States. And according to our own U.S. Senate's website, the United States Constitution provides that the president, quote, shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. So treaties are binding agreements between nations and become part of international law. Treaties to which the United States is a party also have the force of federal legislation, forming part of what the Constitution calls the supreme law of the land. This is important that the Senate itself, it doesn't ratify treaties. Following consideration from the Committee on Foreign Relations, the Senate either approves or rejects a resolution of ratification. If the resolution passes, the ratification takes place when the instruments of ratification are formally exchanged between the United States and the foreign powers. So the Senate has considered and approved for ratification all but a small number of treaties negotiated by the president and his representatives. In some cases, when Senate leadership believed a treaty lacked sufficient support for approval, the Senate simply did not vote on the treaty, and it was eventually withdrawn from the president. Since pending treaties are not required to be resubmitted by the beginning of each new Congress, they may remain under consideration by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for an extended period of time. So in recent decades, presidents have frequently entered the United States into international agreements without the advice and consent of the Senate. These are called executive agreements. Though not brought before the Senate for approval, executive agreements are still binding under the parties of international law. All of that to say that a treaty between a multilateral body and many countries can only affect the United States if it is in fact presented to the Senate and the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee gives it approval for ratification. Then the president can go sign on and it can be ratified. Now the president can sign it, but if it never, the treaty, but if it never goes to the Senate in the first place, it doesn't have any legal effect to Americans. This is what it was referring in the last few sentences about executive agreements. The important case to be made, and I'll move on here. The reason this two-thirds requirement is so key is because if Americans are behind in support an international agreement to the point that they give two-thirds of their senators the go-ahead to sign on, then such an idea, whatever the treaty is related to, climate change, humanitarian rights, pandemics, and fill in the blank, that political issue has gone throughout American society, gaining enough support that the American people are going to be behind it. Now, that is the kind of treaty you want senators to sign, is when that many Americans support it completely, that they're allowing their senators to vote for it. That means it won't be over, perhaps drawn into future criticism, or it'll have full support for whether it's militarily, economically, etc., from the American people. This is a resolution that, in my mind, a treaty like this that reached that threshold is good for the American people because you have both the political left and political right supporting it. However, when you can't get that two-thirds of support in the Senate and a president, for example, just signs that agreement, this can cause problems because now it's drawing Americans' resources into an agreement that hasn't reached the threshold of support by all American people. I want to outline how the political left and the political right view treaties and the ratification of treaties here in the United States, how it should be approached. And this is related to both a pandemic treaty of the future and just treaties broadly speaking. I highlight a couple of individuals writing on this subject, not directly advocating for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party here in the United States, but it, I believe, outlines the viewpoints of both the political left and political right and how their approach to both international cooperation and multilateralism and American sovereignty, it varies quite substantially. So I want to first give the political left perspective on treaty ratification. This is according to Anya Wahal, writing for Council on Foreign Relations. She writes, continuing to refuse to ratify multiple treaties and countless others erodes American global leadership and sends a message to the rest of the world that the United States remains unwilling to commit to action on issues like human rights and arms control. A stalwart commitment to a narrow conception of national sovereignty and the ideal of American exceptionalism undermine the United States' ability to participate as a leader and a partner on the international stage. If President Joe Biden wants to prove that America is back, he should attempt to make progress on signing or ratifying several of major international treaties. Unfortunately, any attempts to ratification will be a tall order in the Senate. Several Republican senators even resist approving routine political appointments. Furthermore, petty political disputes and foreign policy aims on top of the Republican priority of defending natural sovereignty and protecting the U.S. Constitution signal potential political opposition to ratification. After the Trump administration, sovereignty has become almost inextricably linked to the Republican Party platform. If the United States wants to maintain its position as a global leader and further important global and regional policy goals, it must move away from its self-defeating sovereignty obsessions and overcome political barriers despite the odds, according to Anya Wahal. That's a political left perspective on global leadership, American leadership around the world, and how the ratification of treaties signifies that leadership. Let me give you the opposing argument. This is, again, in my mind, representing the political right in the United States from Stephen Groves, who's writing for the Heritage Foundation. He describes a number of treaties that the U.S. hasn't ratified, and he gives his recommendations for the Senate regarding future treaties. Right? The Senate should reject any revival of the above-forementioned international agreements, all of which threaten the sovereignty of the United States. Their failure thus far to attain broad bipartisan support is an indication that they do not enjoy the backing of the American people, nor are they likely to gain its backing. The Biden White House should not negotiate or sign international agreements that have little or no chance of receiving the advice and consent of the Senate. The Biden administration should consult with the Senate on its advice prior to, as well as during, the negotiation of new treaties. In their infinite wisdom, the framers of the Constitution required a two-thirds vote in the Senate to ratify treaties. This is a constitutional requirement and cannot be changed by Senate rule or procedure. As such, bipartisan support will be necessary to join any of the above-mentioned treaties. With an evenly divided Senate, it behooves that body and the White House to pursue only those international agreements that enjoy broad public support. Again, Stephen Groves from the Heritage Foundation. These two viewpoints relating just to this one subject of ratifying treaties, I think reveal so much about the political left and political right in the United States. The political left, in this context, views giving up American sovereignty while gaining global cooperation to address specific issues. On the flip side, the political right dismisses the idea of giving up any American sovereignty, especially for treaties that don't receive enough support to even garner two-thirds of the Senate, which is revealing the lack of support from the American people. These two viewpoints highlight the philosophical disagreements about American leadership around the world, about national sovereignty, whether it's signing on to treaties or another issue of how America should be leading in the world. So I want to close this out with our courses of action in my assessment on the future of international treaties for Americans and how they'll affect our lives. Most likely, its course of action, in my view, that the United States will influence the language of international treaties, especially being one of the largest donors to the United Nations and the World Health Organization. Our Senate will unlikely meet the two-thirds requirements for a treaty that even theoretically limits the American sovereignty. I think its voting record stands behind that statement. The most dangerous course of action, in my view, would be that the executive branch of our government commits the American people to international agreements that have far-reaching impacts but never receive the support of the American people, such as that two-thirds requirement reveals. So my kind of closing thought, bring this back to a pandemic treaty that has multilateral support and hundreds of countries signing on to. I think global cooperation will be key for future pandemics to limit damage and deaths to human lives and the global economy. Now, hope for that cooperation, that's certainly wise. But rather, let's plan and prepare as a country like that cooperation will never exist and we should be okay in the next global pandemic. It's like making preparations for the winter months and you're living in a really cold state. So you hope the electricity never gets kicked off and your heater's always running, but it's probably a good idea to chop some wood and have the fireplace ready. I see the same principle leading us through the next global pandemic. Yes, international cooperation, it will be key to save human lives. However, let's make preparations like that will never actually happen. Those cooperation, transparency, communication, say it'll never exist, and I think we'll be okay. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.